From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here in Utah, in a state of more than 2.5 million people, you often have a very small fraction of them making the crucial decisions about who's elected to office. If you want to be nominated to run for something in the state, you have to make it past a caucus system where delegates to party conventions are chosen. Republicans choose 3,500 delegates, Democrats just less than 3,000. So if you do the math, that's something like 0.2%. 0.2% are the ones making the decision about who gets on the ballot come November. A newly formed group is trying to change this system. They say the delegates who participate this early in the process don't represent the ideas or positions of most voters. Today in the program, we're talking about the state's nominating system and the efforts to change it. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here in Utah, if you want to be nominated to run for something, you have to make it past a caucus system where delegates to party conventions are chosen. It used to be called mass meetings. It's where you go to some public building or sometimes to a house not so far from you, often in the basement or a living room. And you talk about the issues and the candidates. And who is it that shows up to these meetings? Turns out not many, at least not many compared to those who could or should. Republicans choose 3,500 delegates, Democrats just less than 3,000 delegates, and if you did the math, in a state of 2.5 million people, that's something like 0.2%. Now, of course, that is the population figure, not those of registered voters, but just to make the point, 0.2% are the ones making the decision about who gets on the ballot come November. But still, it's 0.2% who show up, who are engaged, even passionate about the political process. A newly formed group is trying to change this system. They say the delegates who participate this early in the process don't actually represent the ideas and the positions of most voters, most mainstream voters. So today in the program, we're talking about the nominating system and the efforts to change it, how it works or doesn't work. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's introduce the panel. We've got a number joining us here in the studio is Kirk Jowers, the director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, the University of Utah. He's part of this coalition I mentioned working to reform the election process, also the former chairman of the Governor's Commission on Strengthening Democracy. And Kirk Jowers, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We should also, here in the studio, Kelly Patterson is with us, professor of political science and the director of the Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy at Brigham Young University is joining us. And Professor, welcome back.
Thank you, Doug.
Thanks for being with us. Frank Pignanelli is joining us, a former Utah lawmaker, an attorney, political advisor, a lobbyist, also co-writes a column for the Deseret News with LeVar Webb. And Frank Pignanelli, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
And Morgan Lyon Cotty is with us, the research director at the Utah Foundation. It's a local research and policy group. They've come up with a report talking about the caucus system. Welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
So let's start about start talking about just how we got to where we are. Morgan Lyon Cotty, I wanted to start with you. How did we get here? Utah adopted this direct primary in 1937, and then in 1947, things changed, and it's kind of been evolving. Just tell us sort of, give us an update and tell us how we got here.
Sure. Well, when we became a state, clear back in 1896, the norm for all states was to have conventions, and so not surprisingly, that's what we adopted. But shortly thereafter, states started to adopt direct primaries. And this was part of the progressive era, trying to give voters more power and trying to take power away from the party machines. And Utah followed suit. In 1937, we adopted a direct primary, but this only lasted about a decade, and some people wonder why it lasted only about that amount of time, and it may be because it was seen as being somewhat politically motivated. It's sometimes called Ma's Law after a powerful Democratic senator who had tried to run for U.S. Senate and governor of Utah but could never get out of convention. And so for that and maybe some other reasons, it only lasted about 10 years. And in 1947, the state adopted a caucus convention system, the structure of which we still basically use today.
Now, the question is... why they stopped, I guess. Bob Bennett wrote a piece. It's kind of exploring the history of it. He says his conclusion was it's because Utahns value independence. They didn't want to declare their party preference. Is he on track there?
You know, that he may have a point, except that to be a part of the Republican primary or even the Republican conventions, you have to be a Republican, a registered Republican. So those people all have declared their party. I think, you know, part of the reason they probably went back to the convention system in 1947 was because of perhaps a pushback to then-Governor Herbert Ma, and also because we actually had quite low voter turnout in those primaries. It was usually around 10%, and we don't know if that's because it was a new primary or, you know, this was during the Great Depression and World War II, so that may have had mitigating factors as well.
So in the 1990s, Utah lawmakers started to give more power to the parties to manage their conventions. I think the threshold started at something like 80%. And then in 96, it was changed to 70%. In 99, I think, if I've gotten this right, it was changed to 60%. Am I right in that?
Partially. It was actually in the 70s and the early 90s, and then the legislature gave more power to the parties in the early 90s, in part because the Supreme Court had upheld the political party's right to association by the First Amendment, and the legislature realized they needed to give parties the power to manage their own affairs. And as part of that, both parties decided to change their thresholds, and the Democrats changed the threshold to 60% in 1996, and the Republicans did in 1999.
Got it. Okay. And we should explain that, that if a candidate can get 60% of the vote of the delegates, they move on.
Right, and that's really something that is unique to Utah. There's only a few other states that also hold conventions, and in those states, candidates need to get, you know, either 15% or 20% of delegate votes, and then they move on to the primary. However, in Utah, it's the top two vote-getters in the convention move on to the primary, and if you, as you just said, if you receive that 60%, you can just go straight to the general election. But Utah is the only state that allows the party to preclude a primary election for major statewide and congressional offices.
Okay, so speaking of just how unique Utah is, put us in perspective our system now. In your report, you talk about that we're one of only seven states that still uses a similar system.
We are, and of those seven states, there's really only three or four of us where the convention is really strong. In Connecticut and Colorado, New Mexico and Utah, the conventions really are choosing those candidates or that get to go on to the primary. A couple of other, North Dakota, for instance, they decide who is the, you know, who's endorsed by the party. But then on the primary ballot, there's nothing that signifies that. And then, for instance, Virginia gets to choose whether to have a primary or a convention, but they haven't had a convention in over a decade. So we see really how rare it is. And even among those states that do use that strong convention, there's another way to get around it. They allow candidates to access the primary via petition. So if they get enough voter signatures, they can still get on the primary ballot. However, Utah is the only one of those convention states that doesn't allow that.
So just how much power does the state under this system give to its party delegates? That seems also unique.
It is, and I think you also have to put it in perspective that there are so many races in Utah where the Republican nominee is basically the person who's going to win because the Republican Party dominates so many districts in Utah. So we see that, you know, the delegates do have a lot of power in choosing who actually ends up in office.
So what kind of conclusions has the Utah Foundation come? You say in the report that Utah's elected leaders may be more focused on making policies supported by party delegates rather than their larger constituencies.
Yeah, and that's a concern that we have in this report. A number of political scientists have found in their work that elected leaders can focus on specific constituent bases that may be very influential in getting them reelected. And here we know that the delegates can be extremely influential in whether someone gets reelected. And the concern here is that delegates don't necessarily represent the electorate as a whole, or even registered Republicans or registered Democrats in the case of Democratic delegates. And we did a survey last year comparing the priorities of the delegates to the general population. And we've actually done this survey. We call it our Utah Priorities Project. We do it every gubernatorial election. And every time we see that education is important and the economy is important. But in 2010, we saw that the Republican delegates had some very specific policy priorities that weren't necessarily in line with the general electorate or with their fellow Republicans. For instance, while both they and registered Republicans felt protecting states' rights and creating a business-friendly economy was very important, delegates also cited protecting gun rights, allowing mining and grazing on federal lands, and preventing illegal immigration. And those were very important. And those were three things that no other group thought were policy priorities, and it's very striking that they did not list education. They were the only group we surveyed that did not list education as a priority.
Morgan Lyon-Cotty, stay with us, research director for the Utah Foundation. It's a local research and policy group. Kelly Patterson, Brigham Young University, give us a sense. I'm not sure if you know this. Why do you figure Utah is unique in this? What is it about? Do you think you have a sense of understanding how it is that Utah decided to stay with this kind of a system and sort of give so much power to its delegates?
Well, it's an interesting question. I haven't done any historical research that would lead me to believe that it's one thing or another. But in the various editorials that have been written lately from Republican leaders and the like who want this kind of system to remain intact, there's this argument that it filters the voice of the people. It harkens back to this theme that you see in the founding period, that you need to be a little suspicious of democracy, especially direct democracy, and that what you need are filters of opinion. And this party system that we have currently in the state of Utah is just an additional filter that you get layered on to the state filter and the federal filter of kind of refining the masses' opinion before it actually gets to the policymaking process.
Because we don't trust them.
We don't trust them. And the founding fathers, in their wisdom, wanted to distance majority opinion and the opinion of the masses from the policymaking arenas.
Who are Utah the people who go to a caucus, for example, from your impression? Who are they? Are they extreme in their views, just particularly engaged? Do we know?
Well, there's a difference between those who actually attend the caucus and those who are actually elected delegates. If you look at some of the research that's been done over time, those individuals who attend the caucuses can be characterized as a little bit more moderate than those people who actually end up being elected delegates. The delegates themselves are quite opinionated, I guess, is the best way to say it. They hold their views very strongly. And so when you talk about strong conservatives, strong Republicans, same thing in the Democratic Party, strong liberal, strong Democrat, it's the same thing. Those individuals who are much more likely to get elected delegates are also a bit older, wealthier, more educated. To go back to what Morgan was saying, it's not just that they're kind of different demographically or even that their opinions are different. It's the intensity with which they hold the opinion sometimes that makes it really different.
Morgan Lyon-Cotty, we have you back.
Doug, I'm back.
You're back. Okay. We're discussing now. I want to get a sense for Kelly Patterson. Let me just go back to you, though, really quickly. Utah voters. Morgan was talking about just how, in their study, what they found Utah voters want in comparison to what you may get from delegates. What is a traditional Utah voter? Center-right?
Yes, center-right.
Center-right, that's the way to sort
strongly of describe Republican, it? Strongly Republican, moderate to strongly conservative.
Strongly Republican, not strongly independent, strongly Republican.
Yeah. Depending on how you measure party identification, obviously.
Sure.
But in the political science literature, it's normally along a 7-point scale. And individuals are allowed to identify with different positions along that scale. And the idea that people are independent is really sort of a myth. only about 10% of the electorate could even be construed as what we might call pure independents. Other people have ideological and partisan leanings, and those ideological and partisan leanings are meaningful when people participate in politics and cast their vote. But individuals who are readily identify out of the gates with one party or another and then kind of strongly identify with that party act differently than the rest of the voters.
Let me put this, Professor Patterson, to you and to Ms. Cotty. The question is, how do Utahns – do we know how Utahns feel about this particular system, this caucus system?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I haven't done any survey research that would lead me to
so we're not sure
conclude
yet.
One way or the other.
Yeah.
And this would be one of those questions where you'd really want to be careful about how you ask it
right.
to Utah voters, because there are values in the system that some of the voters would probably like to see realized. But there are other values that probably aren't so palatable to them either. So like all systems that aggregate public opinion, you have trade-offs.
Yeah.
And so depending on where you place the emphasis on the trade-offs will skew your results.
Morgan Lancott, do you have any sense of that?
There have been a couple of opinion polls that I've seen asking voters how they feel about it. But just as Professor Patterson just said, it sort of depends on how the question is framed and worded, as can be so influential in polling. And if people are asked if they think the system needs to be changed or if they approve of it, I haven't been able to see any pattern or really get a sense of how the public truly feels about it. And to be honest, it seems like a lot of the public doesn't necessarily quite understand the system. It is pretty complicated. It's one of the more complicated ways to actually get on a ballot in the United States. And so I don't think we have a very clear sense about how the public feels about it.
It's Morgan Lyon-Cotty, Research Director for the Utah Foundation. It's a local research and policy group. They've been doing some studies that looks at Utah's caucus system. Kelly Patterson with us, Professor of Political Science, Director of the Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy at Brigham Young University. Also with us here in the studio, Kirk Jowers, the Director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Frank Pignanelli with us, former Utah lawmaker and columnist for the Deseret News. Oh, I should also mention we have invited Thomas Wright, the chairman of the Utah Republican Party. He's very much for this system, by the way. He's going to be joining us a little bit later on the program. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the way the fringes of political parties can often control the process. If you're a Democrat or a Republican in Utah and you want to be nominated to run for something, you have to go through this caucus system in the early days. A newly formed group called the Alliance for Good Government is trying to change that. They say the delegates who participate in this part of the process don't necessarily represent the mainstream voters. We're talking about that system today. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Kirk Jowers is with us, director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, but also with that Alliance for Good Government, as I mentioned. Frank Pignanelli, former Utah lawmaker, columnist for the Deseret News, with us here. We're going to get to Thomas Wright, chairman of the Utah Republican Party, in a moment. We also have, I should just mention, in case they want to jump in, Kelly Patterson of Brigham Young University and Morgan Lyon-Cotty, the research director with the Utah Foundation. Kirk Jowers, to you. What was the clincher? What is it that made you decide, you and a group of others, that we've got to change this system?
Participation. For me, everything.
Voter participation.
Voter participation.
Yeah.
It's just unconscionable to me that our state once led the nation in voter participation, and now we are near the bottom, 45th, 47th, and 49th in the last three elections. And there's no reason for that. We lead the nation in volunteer hours. I think we are a very civic and patriotic minded state. So we need to get engaged. And so,
but what does that mean? Why is it that how is the caucus system having any effect at all on voter turnout?
I think that part's simple. it's 0.2%, as you said in your introduction, that are actually making the most important decisions in almost all elections. If by chance we get a primary, it hits us a little bit by – we're startled by it because we don't get them that often. And when we do, we don't always get the marquee matchups. And we only get about 5 weeks from after the convention where the candidates care at all about the rest of us. So for most of the election, for most of the attention, 99.8% of us are irrelevant to who we elect.
So people aren't going because they figure, what's the point?
What's the point? And they don't even get the option oftentimes because, as Morgan did a great job of illustrating, we have the highest barrier for entry in the country to get on a primary ballot. And so we focus all of this attention on these very few delegates. And if they can get over 60% there, they don't have to face a primary. And the way our state is set up demographically and yet in redistricting and everything else, there are very few general elections that truly matter. And so it's all decided by this very small nugget of people. And they're very powerful. And I mean, frankly, it's political malpractice for these elected officials and their campaign managers to look at anything beyond the delegates. You know, Morgan talked about the strange kind of the difference that the voters and the delegates' opinions and what the top issues are don't match up at all. And so where are you going to look? Not what your voters want, certainly not what the state wants, but what those very few delegates want.
Frank Pignanelli, I guess it's important to say this goes both ways. This is not just a Republican or a conservative issue. Does it have the same effect on the left?
Well, absolutely. And first of all, let me just I come into this with unclean hands because not only do you have the issue of the delegates, but you can play games with the delegates, and no one was better at that than I was. When we were rebuilding the Democratic Party back in the mid-80s, there were some old codgers that we wanted to get out of the way. And so we used the delegate system to do that. And it wasn't just so much getting delegates lined up the system, but we would go and manipulate the system, the convention, getting people uncredentialed as delegates, get our own people placed in. I got sued for it. Happy I did. We ended up with the right result. But
you're saying it's easy to manipulate.
There's a darker side, and of all your guests, I'm the one person was in that swamp, and happy to have been there. I have still the stench of it. So this isn't just going in, getting people to run in their precinct caucuses. It's all the games that are played, and they are played. Let me tell you about that. And so there is the darker side. For example, one of the things that I saw happen, we were rebuilding the Democratic Party, and then as some of these other hot-button issues became more and more prevalent in the early 90s, whether it was abortion or education reform or things like that, all of a sudden the litmus test really got geared up inside the Democratic Party. We actually lost some good legislators inside convention battles because of the different stands that they took, and it became more and more impossible for moderate Democrats to get through the convention process. And you can't blame it entirely on the digital process, but you can blame a lot of it on there. People who are running for office, it became harder for them to become attractive in a general election ballot for Democrats. And that's a big deal. You have more leeway as a Republican. As a Democrat, you have to go attract independents. You have to go attract Republicans if you want to win statewide or even a congressional election. And look what happened to Jim Matheson. I mean, a Matheson, for hell's sakes, you know, a beloved member of the royalty, is put into a Democratic primary. I mean, that just by the delegates. And so that is just a phenomenal thing that's going on. The other thing I point to, and I warned the Republicans, I said, it's beyond hope in many ways for the Democrats. I mean, the Democratic Party merged with the Green Party 4 years ago. I would bet most of people listening don't realize that. We merged with the Green Party, and I may have been the only person that complained about it. It's like, what? Because the delegate system is like, yeah, it makes sense to us. Let's just all merge it. The guy that was honored by the delegates 5 years ago in a convention is now starting his own political party. And those delegates would honor him again because they're so whacked. So I'm just saying it's time to move on because the average delegate, at least on the left side, does not represent the traditional Utah Democrat. And I know I'll get some heat for that, but I'm happy to defend that.
Well, you're used to that. Kurt Jowers, what is the practical effect then of having – let's just assume your contention is right now, both of you, that the extremes of the parties are the ones that are most influential at this point. What's the effect on policy? What's the effect? You mentioned voter turnout. That's one effect you're worried about. But does it have another effect? Does it affect policy? Does it affect the relationship between a voter and their representative, for example?
Consistently, you find that when voter participation goes down, polarization goes up, extremism goes up, and the ability to work together goes down. And so, and that all makes sense. Also, the public good becomes less powerful in relation to special interests because the fewer people participating, the more powerful those individuals are. So, all of those things are true. But it's always hard to follow Frank. But
you're going to have to scream.
I'm going to
curse a little may help too.
But it is an amazing thing, and we are looking at something that doesn't get rid of the caucus convention system. So I should be clear about that because I do think it has served us well at times, and it can serve us well. There are some good parts to it, but.
Go back. What is the plan? I mean, what is the alternative right now? Because what you're not saying is, as you said, strip it out entirely.
Right. So as Morgan said, there are 44 states who use the primary. Virginia is the interesting one. They could do caucus convention. The parties could, but they don't. So there's 44 states that use a direct primary. And then there's 5 states that have caucus convention with a parallel path, and I'll explain that parallel path. And then there's Utah. So we are all by ourselves. We are an absolute outlier. So all we are asking is – all that we are proposing at the moment is to allow this parallel track. The parallel track means that caucus convention is still controlled by the parties. They can do however they want, and those people would still make it to the ballot per the party's rules, the 60-40 that you discussed. The parallel track would be that by a petition, you could go around and get, in most states, it's 2% of the registered voters in your district or statewide if you're going for Senate, U.S. Senate or governor, and that would be an alternative route to the ballot. The wonderful thing about this is that every other state that has it is voting at about 10% higher rate than we are. It also
turnout,
yep. Voter turnout, and it also forces every candidate to at least keep a little bit of an eye on the rest of the state, on the other 99.8% of us.
Because they've got to collect signatures.
And because they know they will actually have a primary. So I want more primaries. That's my pitch. Some people fault us for saying we don't want to be just one of 6. We want to be one of the 44. I think we've got some heritage in our caucus convention system. We should keep it, and that this incremental step is the right direction without really flipping the ox cart over.
Let me ask Kelly Patterson and Morgan Lyon-Cotty, do you know the presumption that lawmakers are not aligned with we'll just sort of broadly say lawmakers, members of Congress as well as state lawmakers, aren't necessarily in alignment with their constituencies. Is that a correct presumption?
Yeah, that's a correct presumption. Morgan, being a political scientist like myself, right, knows that one of the main findings in political science is that representatives are responsive to the constituents who are most influential at moving them forward in their career. And you know that if you have to a certain constituency to whom you are beholden, then that constituency is going to be very influential when you think about the stances you're going to take and the kinds of positions you're going to articulate and the kind of legislation you're going to introduce. I think a classic example of this is a Senator Orrin Hatch in an effort to, I think, really avoid a bloody convention battle has gone out of his way to de-emphasize some of his more moderate positions that he's taken over the course of his career and play to the base of delegates who are more conservative than your average Republican voter in the state of Utah.
Morgan Lyon-Cotty, anything to add to that?
Sure. Perhaps an example of someone who was trying to be more in touch with her larger base of delegates and wasn't thinking about, her larger constituency and not her base of delegates was former Governor Eileen Walker. In 2004, she received only 14% of the delegate votes in the Republican convention, making it so that she did not even continue to the primary. And I believe she was our first governor not to be, our first sitting governor not to be reelected in something like 50 years. And but at the time, she had an 80% approval rating with Utah voters. So it's interesting in Utah to see, you know, what group of constituents you do need to be aware of and in line with to, in order to be reelected.
One of the things I'm just going to assert, I mean, I'm going to put it in starker terms as I always do. This is why these guys are spooked. They saw what happened to Bob Bennett. But even as recently as 2 or 3 months ago, you had special
elections. Let's explain, Bob Bennett was ousted in a party convention,
by delegates, by people, you know, who showed up precinct caucuses, by delegates.
Said to be strongly influenced by the Tea Party movement, we should say.
Very influenced by the Tea Party movement. You had two special elections just in the last several months for legislators, one who passed away, another one who resigned, Chris Butters. You had sitting House members running to replace them and inside the delegates, and they were – you had outsiders come in who appealed to the Tea Party system. And so those delegates replaced it. That's why the next legislative session, probably more than any other legislative session, where you're going to have these 104 lawmakers – immediately focused on that handful of delegates, because they know that, especially on the Republican side, these guys could take them out, and that's all they're talking about in many ways. How do I keep these delegates happy?
I want to get there is a strong defense to be made for this caucus system, and it's generally made by Thomas Wright, who is chairman of Utah's Republican Party. He's joining us today, and Thomas by phone. Thomas Wright, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's begin with your sense of the caucus system right now. Are you suggesting that there isn't anything inherently wrong with this system? Your biggest concern is just getting more people to participate?
Yeah, that's basically it. And that's what I hear everybody saying in this conversation today, is that we all agree that participation is at an all-time low, and that's where we need to focus our attention. If you don't have people participating in the process, then it's really hard to have, an outcome where everybody feels like they're represented. And the thing that I love about the caucus convention system is that whether you're a school teacher in Sandy or you're a construction worker in Farmington or a nurse in St. George, you get to have a voice, and you can have a relationship with your elected official. Also, the cost of run for office is a lot less, which means that anybody can run. If we go to a direct primary system, the candidates with the highest name ID that are the most well-funded and can run the best soundbite campaigns will win. And another thing I love about it is that Utah is different than all the other states. I'm proud of that. I look around the country right now. I don't see very many states that I want to be like. I'd rather be Utah than pretty much any other state in the country, if not all states in the country. So we're doing something right. Other states are coming to emulate what we're doing. We have our AAA bond rating. We're consistently ranked number one in almost every single category. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to improve, or that there isn't things about the caucus convention system that can't be improved. But I don't know why we want to be like everybody else when we see what being like them got them. And so that argument for me is really, really hard to understand. And I guess the biggest thing for me is the worst problem we have in this country right now is that it's run by a permanent ruling class of people. And the caucus delegate system allows and offers people the best chance to elect newcomers that don't have to have large amounts of money and huge name ID. And the government belongs to the people. We should keep it as close to the people as we can.
So, but you're hearing the contention. Two things I want you to respond to in particular. One is that what you've ended up with under this system is state lawmakers, well, not just state lawmakers, lawmakers, elected officials whose ideas, ideology in particular, doesn't align with mainstream constituents, that they're not representative, in fact, of mainstream Utah voters. And they tend to be Republican. They tend to be conservative, but maybe not just as conservative as all of that. How do you respond to that, first of all?
Well, I think there's two comments. One is, politics is cyclical, and things change over time. We've seen the pendulum in politics swing back and forth before. A second is, the Republican delegates are not supposed to represent everybody in Utah. They're supposed to be representing Republicans in the state of Utah. There isn't anything that stops anyone from starting their own political party. There's nothing that stops somebody from running as an independent. So there's no reason to go legislate and tell a political party what they have to do. That's like saying, Microsoft has to take my program that's not part of Microsoft and put it into Windows because it's not fair if they don't. I mean,
We're not talking about Democrats, and let's even throw independents out there. Mm-hmm. I think the contention is that among mainstream Republicans, the lawmakers that are being elected aren't reflective of their ideology. It was a point made earlier on the program. You don't agree with that?
I don't agree with that, and I'll tell you why. Take the case of Olene Walker, which has been mentioned on this program. She did have an 80% approval rating. People approved of the job that she was doing. But when she had to run against other people, they found another candidate more desirable. That candidate was John Huntsman. I can't think of a more mainstream Republican than John Huntsman. And his approval rating was equally as high. And he was one of the most popular governors the state's ever had. He was produced by the caucus convention system. He got the nomination in the convention. Mike Leavitt was a great mainstream Republican, self-proclaimed. I thought Mike Leavitt was a great governor. He was produced by the caucus convention system. Orrin Hatch is a product of the caucus convention system. Bob Bennett was a product of the caucus convention system. And in the case of Bob Bennett, that year, the incumbents all over the country got thrown out of office. I don't remember the numbers right off the top of my head, but you have the largest freshman class of U.S. senators and U.S. House of Representatives, meaning more incumbents lost in 2010 than probably any other year in the history of this country. There was major discontent with Washington. There was major discontent with anybody who had been a part of the system, and all across the country, incumbents lost. So Bob Bennett wasn't an anomaly, and I don't accept the assertion that he would have won for sure in a primary. Might he have? Yes, I would accept that. But I don't think that was an absolute certainty, because if you look across the country, incumbents all across the country in both political parties lost.
So you're saying, but you're not suggesting Mike Lee is more representative than Bob Bennett was of mainstream Utah voters, or are you?
I don't know about that. I know that in the convention, Tim Bridgewater got 58% about of the delegate vote, 2% shy of being the nominee. And then Mike Lee went on to win the primary. So if somebody were hypothetically to make the argument that Mike Lee was the most conservative candidate and not representative of the people, why did he do better in the primary and win and do less well, so to speak, and not get as many votes as Tim Bridgewater in the convention? So you know, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In the convention, they voted for the less conservative person, and then the primary voted the more conservative. And some people would argue that that's because Mike Lee had better television advertising. He ran a better campaign down the stretch. And that was my point earlier. The better-funded name ID candidates will win primaries, and the rest of the people won't have a chance. And I don't believe in that. I think that anybody should be able to run for public office, and they ought to have a voice. And I think it's great that Orrin Hatch, who's running for re-election, and he'll be challenged, is going around the state meeting with every neighborhood in the state. There's going to be a delegate from every neighborhood in the state. And it's not fair to say that 2/10 of 1% is making the decision, because that 2/10 of 1%, those 3,500 delegates, are being elected by about 58,000 Republicans. This year we're going to try to push that to 100,000 Republicans, which would be about 20% of total Republicans.
But
they're just being anointed.
But Mr. Wright,
they're being elected in neighborhood elections.
But if you did hear I hope you heard anyway, the contention earlier made that in fact these delegates, these 58,000 delegates, they're different from the people who attend the caucus meetings and the delegates. There's a difference there. The people who are actually voted as delegates tend to be more. Did you use the word extreme, Kelly Patterson?
Well, they hold their opinions much more strongly, and ideologically, if you talk about it along a distribution, more extreme.
So, what do you make of that?
Well, you know, I'm a member of an HOA. Let's say the people that care the most about the properties are going to show up to the meeting, and they're going to have a larger voice than the people who don't care about the HOA and don't show up to their meeting. So that's true in any organization, that the people that show up have a louder voice. Of course they do, because they're there. And so that's where I think all this energy should be placed, at least in 2012, is let's put our energy toward making sure people understand what night the caucuses are being held, what they are, why they are important, and how important it is to just go vote for a delegate or even run to be a delegate. Because I think the people don't necessarily understand the process, and I think that is a failure on behalf of political parties, political leaders in this state, really everybody is accountable. We've got to do a better job of getting people to participate, not just in our caucuses, but in our elections, because like was pointed out earlier, we have one of the lowest participation rates in the country.
That's always my favorite quote from Chairman Wright, who I adore. I think he's doing a great job. But he always says we need to spend time and energy educating people about the system. We've had this since 1896. And we still can't figure it out. As Kelly said, Morgan said, it's about the most complicated system we have. So 130 years later, we don't need to educate them about the candidates or the policies. We need to help people figure out how to get involved in our system. And I think that's part of the problem. People under 30 do not attend these. If you're a delegate, over 80%, I think the data shows, have lived in Utah for over 20 years or over 55 years old, and Kelly alluded to those. It's an impenetrable system.
But what Thomas Wright seems to be saying is, if they knew there was the system, if they knew they could get there, if we just got the word out, they would show up. You're saying it wouldn't matter because they feel like it's being influenced by the extremes.
No, that the extreme part is not my biggest contention because
it's turnout.
It's opportunities for people to participate. If more extreme people turn out and vote,
but turnout is directly related to the sense that there's an extreme that's over influencing, isn't it? Can you disconnect them?
Yes or no? I mean, you could actually deepen the pool of participation in these neighborhood meetings and not necessarily dilute the influence of ideology. There are a lot of ideological voters out there who have not yet been mobilized to participate. And what we do know from political science is that those individuals who care the most about it, and this is what Chairman Wright said, care the most about an issue, who have the most intensely held opinions, are the ones who are most likely to show up. Individuals who also have time, resources, education, those are the individuals who are going to show up. You will deepen the pool of those individuals at the neighborhood meetings. You won't necessarily broaden the pool in a way that is going to dramatically shift the ideological bias.
So what's the point then, Kirk Jowers? What's the point?
Well, to me, the point is to have this parallel track because it at least involves all Republican voters or all Democratic voters in that choice from the start to the finish. If you look at it, the analogy would be in the 1890s, the entire neighborhood had these homes. We now have 44 have torn down and built new homes. 5 have added air conditioners. All we want to do is put an air conditioner in this Utah home. And I think if we do that, it will make it a much more comfortable place for everyone to have their say. For those people who can go for those 3 hours on caucus night, it's still there in exactly the same form it is. For those who can spend the 8 hours at the convention and want to be a delegate, they can do that. For those single parents, for those LDS missionaries, service members, people who are disabled who can't attend a caucus meeting because it's in a place that's not ADA rated, there's still a place in Utah's democracy for them to participate.
And there's one more thing that needs to be added here, and that is that goes along with what Kirk is saying, and that is political science has shown in a great deal of research that not everybody is comfortable in the same sort of participatory environment. Face-to-face deliberation is hard for some people. Face-to-face deliberation creates conflict and tension with neighbors. Not everybody's comfortable about talking about politics. So you've actually set up a system that it makes it really difficult for individuals of a certain personality type or disposition to actually be involved.
Thomas Wright, let me ask you to respond to that and to that question that what Kirk Jowers and the others in the Alliance for Good Government, they're not asking to strip away the system, and they're not calling for a direct primary. They're asking for something in between. What's wrong with that?
I don't know if there's anything wrong with it per se, but I think what's happening is this. I just look at it like this. If 2% of the people can get a candidate on a ballot, have we solved the participation problem, or are we just creating another way to put people on a ballot with little participation? And also on that, what will happen is if a candidate has to gather 96,000 signatures, or however many it is at the time, this is what will happen. The candidate will go out and he'll raise money from special interest groups so that somebody on his behalf will go door to door. They'll hire an army of people to go door to door to get enough signatures to get on the ballot. Then the candidate's on the ballot, and let's say that candidate wins. Who are they now beholden to? They're beholden to the people who helped get them on the ballot through paying for people to go get signatures. I believe that the biggest problem we have in government is that there's this permanent ruling class of people, there's too much money in politics, it's controlled by special interest groups, and if we want to keep it close to the people and we want to keep elected officials accountable to the people and not the special interest groups, this is the way to go about doing it. And I would like to see more energy and attention put into educating people. It's not that complicated. We learn much more complicated things in life than this. People are smart. They understand things when they're explained correctly. And if we tell them, hey, your neighborhood has an election, a couple people from your neighborhood are going to go decide who the candidates are, there's nothing complicated about that. I just find it hard to believe that we're going to solve the participation problem by saying that in parallel track that requires 2% of the people to sign a petition is the answer. Because when people knock on my door to sign a petition, I usually just hurry up and sign it so that I can go back inside and be with my family. I don't read it. I don't really understand what's going on. And I'm not saying I've done that in the past or I haven't. I just don't think that that's a true vetting process to get somebody's name put on a ballot. I think there should be a stronger accountability mechanism for that.
Thomas Wright, chairman of the Utah's Republican Party, thanks very much for joining us. We need to take a break. Let me also acknowledge Kirk Jowers, director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics. He's with that group, Alliance for Good Government. Kelly Patterson, professor of political science at Brigham Young University. Morgan Lyon-Cotty, senior research analyst for the Utah Foundation. Frank Pignanelli, also here, columnist for the Deseret News, an attorney and a lobbyist as well. But we've got to take a break. I'm way late on this break. Forgive me. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring Utah's unique nominating system, how it works or doesn't, and where voters seem to be on all of this. Kirk Jowers with us, along with Morgan Lyon-Cotty, Kelly Patterson, Frank Pignanelli, Thomas Wright as well. Kelly Patterson of Brigham Young University, you wanted to respond.
Well, Chairman Wright raises an interesting point about the role of influence, the role of money, and how it influences politics. And there is a significant role that money plays in politics. There's no question about that. If that's the case, then you should also probably be thinking about campaign finance reform in the state. That, you know, this is a state that is essentially unregulated when it comes to campaign finance. So, yeah, there are a variety of ways to attack this problem.
We'll just take that as a point, Kelly Patterson,
yeah,
and move on. I'm sure we can talk about that a little bit later. Let me ask you this, though. How does this particular argument, how does this apply in a broader sense nationally? What you're seeing in national politics on the right and the left, particularly now as you see as Republican candidates in these early days, you know, before the Iowa caucuses, before New Hampshire, moving to the right to sort of appeal to the base. And then by the time a general election comes, you know, they've sort of established themselves on one side or the other. Is this a question you worry about nationally as well, Kirk Jowers?
Certainly, I think everyone will admit that right now we are more polarized than we've been in decades, maybe generations. Some will say ever, and it really is stopping us from solving some basically simple problems to solve that need to be solved. Just because we aren't allowed to reach across the aisle at all, we've seen that with Bob Bennett. He had a 94, I think, lifetime conservative union rating, but he had tried to reach across the aisle on health care, a problem everyone knew was there, and on and with TARP, with the economic downturn, and those two things had become litmus tests that took him out. And Speaker Wright is correct, or Chairman Wright, I think the Speaker Wright from the 80s who was kicked out of office. That
Jim
won't
Wright,
happen.
Why did that come to your mind? Okay, keep going.
That won't happen to Thomas, but. But you know, that is the big problem right now, is especially for our representatives. The gerrymandering across the country has been so defined and so perfect that really it's tough to ever reach across, because the only way you'll ever lose is from a challenge from your left, if you're a Democrat, or right, if you're a Republican.
Frank, I'm guessing you feel some way about this.
I'm going to put it, you know, politics is changing in terms of how the message is delivered. The national participation in the Republican debates has been phenomenal. It's been great to watch, because Republicans, Democrats, Independents have all been watching these debates. What you have is there's an interest by the general population to what's going on, which means people want to know, they want to participate. They can do a lot of stuff now on the web. And so that means the focus by people in politics is changing. I think there's a real hunger for participation. The delegate system doesn't allow that. One of the reasons why Mike Lee was able to win was because long before the convention, the delegates, he had all these little constitutional seminars and things like that. And to his credit, he built up the momentum. He probably would have maybe even come out of the convention because of the momentum, but there was a little crappy mailer that was sent out against him. And because of the delegate and convention system, he didn't have a chance to respond to that. We have to keep in mind these delegates are making decisions on a hot Saturday afternoon, and they don't have the benefit of those in a primary general election where they can go to the web and do fact checks and things like that. So I would agree with Chairman Wright in one sense that you want to open up the participation. But that Saturday afternoon for both parties doesn't provide for that. Let the people who obviously are hungry on a national level, on a local level, for information that's available through the internet, let them use that in their decision-making process. The delegate system does not allow for that.
Completely out of time. Frank Pignanelli, columnist for the Deseret News, attorney and lobbyist. Thanks very much, Frank, for being with us. Kirk Jowers, director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah, with the Alliance for Good Government. Are you going to be able to get it on the ballot? So quick. You know,
if we do that, it won't be until 2014. We've agreed to work with some legislators and party leaders to see if we can improve it during this next year.
Kelly Patterson, professor of political science at Brigham Young University, thanks very much for being with us. And Morgan Lyon-Cotty, senior research analyst at the Utah Foundation, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.